From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. And coming up this hour, he was Israel's ambassador to the United States from 2009 to 2013. Now, Michael Oren has written a behind-the-scenes look at the strained relations between Israel and its closest ally. He describes how President Obama's relationship with Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu turned so bitterly sour, and why he feels the Obama administration abandoned Israel over Iran and the breakdown of peace talks with the Palestinians. His book has been praised for its candor, but widely criticized for some of its conclusions. Michael Oren joins us for the hour. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. And my guest this hour is Michael Oren. He served as Israel's ambassador to the United States during President Obama's first term in office, a period that saw diplomatic relations between the two countries slip to an all-time low. Disagreements over West Bank settlements, peace talks, and nuclear negotiations with Iran, and more. It's all described in his new memoir titled Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide. Michael Oren, welcome to Forum.
Good to be with you, Scott.
Let me begin just by asking you about something in the news this morning. The State Department has extended the deadline for these nuclear talks in Vienna to July 7th, another week or so added to that. What's your take?
Well, I wasn't surprised. I would have been very surprised if it actually signed something yesterday. And the truth is the Iranians have internalized that the longer they stay at the table, the more concessions they're going to get. The Obama administration, from the outset in 2009, said that the window for diplomacy with Iran wouldn't remain permanently open. And in fact, the Iranians have learned that it never really closes. So I think it's in their interest to stay at the table and try to exact a few more concessions before perhaps at some point signing something.
Is there anything – Israel, of course, vehemently opposed to a deal with Iran. But is there anything you could live with that you think is within the framework of what's being discussed now?
And it's important to point out that we're talking about something close to a national consensus. I'm now in the Knesset of Israel, and we have multi-parties, and we're on the left and the right and the up and down, Arabs and Jews. And it's unusual for these parties to agree on anything. We have close to complete, you know, wall-to-wall, side-to-side agreement that this is a bad agreement.
Of course, you don't know what the agreement is yet.
We have an idea of the parameters. But I'll give you an example of what would be a good agreement, and what would be a good agreement is not in this agreement. For example, there is no linkage between enabling Iran to have any type of enrichment capacity, its nuclear facilities, and a change in Iranian behavior.
Behavior with regard to
many things.
Hezbollah.
Iran is the world's largest state sponsor of terror. Iran has been trying to overthrow pro-Western governments in the Middle East. Iran has killed more Americans with its various proxy organizations than any other organization or entity other than al-Qaeda. Iran openly pledges to destroy Israel. So Israel, right at the back, would like to see, okay, you want to have a nuclear deal with Iran, tie it into the way the Iranians behave. Start with that.
So you don't think it can work the other way, that once you have a more of a relationship, for example, now Iran and the U.S. are cooperating in Iraq, even though they're doing all these other things you described. I mean, there are places where our interests overlap.
Having said that, though, it's a huge gamble. And President Obama has gone on record saying that the Iran regime is rational. It's anti-Semitic, but it's rational. It operates on a cost-benefit analysis. This is not the Israeli reading. Israeli reading is that Iran may do rational things, take rational steps to reach irrational goals, much as the Germans did in World War II. And for Israel, it's just too much of a roll of the dice. Our margin for error with Iran, it's exactly zero. We're a tiny country. We're in Iran's backyard. We are threatened with national annihilation. The United States is much further away. It's much bigger. It's not threatened with genocide by the Iranians. So America can take certain gambles that we simply can't.
You started this tour that you're on for your book with an op-ed. And the title of the op-ed, which I realize you did not write the title, but the title in the Wall Street Journal was How Obama Abandoned Israel. And you go on to say in the article that that nobody has a monopoly on mistakes, and certainly Israel has made its share, but they weren't done deliberately. Only one side did that, and that was President Obama and the United States. Is that a fair characterization?
It's a fair characterization with regard to what actually says in the article, which is that Obama made a decision early in his presidency to abandon what had been longstanding policy, American policy toward Israel, on two core principles. And the two core principles were no surprises and no daylight. No surprises meant simply that if America was going to make a major pronouncement on Middle East policy that impacted Israel's interests and security, then Israel would get a chance to look at that document and submit its comments. It's not a veto, but it's a chance to comment on it. No daylight meant we could have our disagreements.
Let me just stop you there. Why should Israel, what's the case for Israel having a relationship like that where they can review American policy?
Because we are allies. And
Israel, but we don't give – do we give that to Germany or France?
Germany doesn't live in our neighborhood. And with all due respect, maybe perhaps with regard to missile issues with the Russians, the Germans would be let into the picture if it impacts German security interests. But Israel is in a very, very tough neighborhood, and America is our sole and greatest ally in the world. And I think it was a fair part. Starting from the middle Reagan years from 85, that was the policy. You know, once in a while it was violated both by Israelis and by Americans, but very rarely, and very rarely on issues that were of utmost importance for Israel's security. The Obama administration decided not to maintain that principle, and it begins in June 2009 when the president goes to Cairo and gives a very long speech. It's actually twice as long as his first inaugural address, about America's relationship with what he called the Muslim world and his outreach to it, and that included quite unprecedented support for Palestinian issues. He's the first time the president says that Iran has the right to a peaceful nuclear program, which was a significant departure from U.S. policy, which impacted us. We had no chance to review that, and that remained the policy, and that was the principle of no daylight. And that's simply that we can have our differences, and we're going to have differences, but we don't air them publicly.
Yeah, but coming back to this idea that only President Obama made mistakes or injured the relationship deliberately. I mean, you've got Prime Minister Netanyahu inviting Mitt Romney to his house. He and his wife entertained mm-hmm. Mitt Romney during the presidential election. Twice, I think, during a visit by Vice President Biden, Israel announced expansion of settlements, very sensitive issues.
You're getting all that's all in the article, by the way.
I list them in
the book, and I list them as Israel's mistakes.
But you say they weren't deliberate.
Well, with Biden, definitely. I was there, and both times, not only was the vice president surprised by these announcements, but the prime minister was surprised by the announcements. They were made by some mid-level official for whatever reasons. And the prime minister in both cases apologized and profusely publicly. And we put into place a mechanism which would enable us to avoid similar situations in the future. And again, it didn't happen after that.
What about the dinner?
The dinner was interesting because I also was there for that. And it was a dicey situation because Mitt Romney came to Israel, much as Senator Barack Obama came to Israel during the 2008 campaign. Candidates tend to come to Israel.
They do, yeah.
And they all meet with the prime minister. And the next day, Mitt Romney actually held a fundraising event at the King David Hotel and wanted the prime minister to come. Prime minister did not come. It was difficult to stay out of this election.
Well, he didn't just meet with the prime minister. The prime minister had him over to his home for dinner. I mean, that's a very intimate sort of setting.
It is indeed, and I will say that he would have done the same thing with Barack Obama. They wasn't the prime minister at the time. Netanyahu was in the opposition. But when candidates come, they're hosted. But I do say in the article that we could have done more, I think, to dispel the impression that Israel was sort of campaigning for one side in that election. I know from my own personal experience it was a brutal period as both parties tried to make Israel a wedge issue. The first YouTube clip that came out and said that the other party is anti-Israel was a Democratic YouTube clip, and I feature very prominently in it. Yeah.
I'm mm-hmm. thinking, though, you know, the title of your book is Ally, and you've said this morning that, you know, Israel and the U.S. have this unshakable alliance. There has historically been very little, if any, daylight between the two mm-hmm. countries. And yet, if you take a step back and not thinking about it as countries, but just two friends who are, you know, one is so reliant for its survival on the other. Let's say I've given you a job,
right,
and I'm supporting your family, and I make sure that, you know, your pets are fed and you have security at your home. I would go out of my way not to poke you in the eye publicly.
I fully agree with you, and it's one of my policy recommendations at the end of the book.
So what
that
happened?
Israel should not go out of its way. Well,
but on the contrary. But it's done the contrary, yeah, it seems, under Prime Minister Netanyahu.
And as I said, no one has a monopoly over mistake making here.
But you also said those mistakes were not intentional, but it seems like they're quite intentional.
No, but there are steps that Israel takes which have been unhelpful. For example, the United States will stick by us in the UN Security Council, and the next day the Israeli government will announce a large settlement construction plan. I don't think that's a prudent move. And I make a strong recommendation at the end of the book that every step that Israel makes, it takes into consideration what are the impact on its relations with the United States. How does this look through American eyes? Because a superpower sees the world differently than a small regional power. But having said that, it's important to note that this is not a one-way relationship. Yes, the United States is Israel's ultimate ally, but the United States really has no substitute for Israel either. This is Israel is situated at the nexus of three continents. You don't get a better strategic situation than that. We are a technologically and scientifically robust country. We have an army that's more than twice as big as the French and British armies combined. We've never known a second of non-democratic governance, and we're part of a very small group of countries like that in the world. It's the United States, New Zealand, Canada, a very small group. And we are the only country in this entire region, and not only in the region, which is unreservedly, unabashedly pro-American. You know, no one's ever burning an American flag. That's a very, very important ally to have. And you go to anybody in the Pentagon or in the CIA, they'll tell you the same thing.
Michael Oren is my guest this hour on Forum. His new book is called Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide. He's the former ambassador of Israel to the United States. You write in the book that you were in charge when you became ambassador right at the beginning of President Obama's first term. You were in charge of Obama 101.
Well, that's what I called the course I gave to myself.
Yeah. So describe that, and how did you go about educating yourself? What did you look at?
So first, understand that I'm not a career diplomat. I'm an historian.
And American-born, I should say.
And American-born, educated. And had taught at several American universities. And I used an historian's tools to try to figure out who is this man. Remember, keep in mind, it's 2009. Not everybody knows that much about the president. Certainly Israelis didn't know
How
much about him.
How concerned were Israelis and the government in particular that you did have American president, Mulayim Hussein, father was Muslim? How much of a concern was that?
It was a concern in the sense of worldview. And that's why I set out to find out what is this world? What does the world look like from President Obama's perspective? And I went into all of his speeches, all of his interviews, the books he wrote about themselves, I think, especially his first book, Dreams from My Father, which was really a look inside this man's soul. I thought it was a deeply revealing book, and made some basic conclusions. What were the conclusions? Yes, he had a different worldview than that with previous presidents going back, say, to Reagan. A heavy emphasis on a sort of a collegial approach to international affairs. America would not be the world's policeman anymore. Would work with other countries. Heavy emphasis on international organizations like the UN, which were not always friendly to Israel. A very strong support for the Palestinian case and to reconcile with Iran. That was right up front from the get-go. Keep in mind that a president's his first pronouncements is a New Year's greeting to the Persian people. It's the first time an American president since 1979 had referred to the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Was that troubling?
We had to take it into consideration.
Was it troubling, though?
The parts of it were troubling indeed. There were parts of it that weren't troubling. I'll tell you what wasn't troubling. Here was a president who was saw himself as a natural bridge between America and the Muslim world. Now, this is ancient history, 2009. This is a period when the president would mention his Muslim family ties in almost every setting, including the first inaugural address, his first television interview in Al Arabiya Television of Dubai, his first visits abroad were to Turkey and Egypt. He talked about this. So on one hand, you could say this is a challenge, and it was. On the other hand, here's an opportunity. Here's a president who's going into the heart of these Muslim countries and talking about America's commitment to Israel. Now, that was an opportunity and to be acknowledged.
You also saw his trip to Cairo without stopping in Israel as a big slight, like a deliberate slight.
And what happened is he was enjoying very high popularity in Israel. You know, here he received about 78% of the American Jewish vote, and he was very popular. Similar numbers in Israel itself.
Still is, okay.
Still quite high. But his popularity after the Cairo speech went down to 4% in Israel. It imploded. It's not about feeling good. It's about a lifeline. And when the president skips over you like that, Israelis get scared, I think justifiably.
Yeah.
And that was the reaction.
One of the things you write, which has gotten a lot of attention, is in sort of his approach, of President Obama's approach to the Muslim world. I can imagine how a child raised by a Christian mother might see himself as a natural bridge between her two Muslim husbands. I could also speculate how that child's abandonment by those men could lead him many years later to seek acceptance by their co-religionists, other Muslims. Wow. What did you mean by that?
What I meant was, in trying to analyze any figure, you want to find about his family connections. It's important. I use the same methodology in analyzing Netanyahu in the book. I talk about his relationship with his father. Not an easy relationship, by the way.
Yeah.
His relationship
and we should
with his
just
brother.
Say you're not a psychologist.
I'm not a psychologist, and I don't pretend to understand the psychology of it, but understand that these people had interesting relationships with their fathers. And what was so interesting about the Obama 101 course that I gave myself was that the president was so candid in talking about his own experiences. Now, in that book, Dreams from My Father,
that was 1995, I think.
But he wasn't running for office,
right?
That was what
it's funny. He sat right there. I interviewed him that year. He
that's
happened
amazing.
To be in town.
He wasn't running.
And
for
he wasn't running for office,
and that's why. And he talks about the pain. He talks about the pain of abandonment. Now that has an impact on you. And at one point, he was very forthright about it. And I wanted to know what that meant. Now, and I, in the book, I talk about, you know, at the risk of armchair psychoanalyzing, saying I'm not a psychoanalyst, but he's saying this about himself. What is my duty as an ambassador to understand the president of the United States and how his policies might impact us? Let's look at his personal background. I think that's it's more than a legitimate question. It's kind of a duty.
There's been a lot of armchair psychoanalysis also of President George W. Bush's relationship with his father. And many felt that, you know, his invasion of Iraq was to basically right a wrong he felt that his father had made by leaving Iraq too soon. Would you agree that that war, the Iraq war, the invasion of Iraq, was probably helped Iran more than anything that has happened in the last decade?
Well, I had an unusual experience, not an easy one. In 2003, I was invited to give testimony to the House Subcommittee on Middle East Affairs. And this is really just right after the invasion. And I appeared there with my professor, my former professor, Bernard Lewis of Princeton, who was a strong advocate of the Iraq War, if you remember.
Yes.
A fabulous professor, by the way, great scholar, but I disagreed with him about the Iraq War. I thought the Iraq War was a mistake. I thought if you wanted to exact revenge against Saddam Hussein, you know, be my guest, but do not, I said to the United States, don't get involved in state making in the Middle East. The British tried it and failed. The French tried it and failed. You're not going to hold these states together. They can only be held together with savage power. America's not cut out for that, was my feeling. And I warned that when Iraq falls apart, the Iranian border is going to move 800 miles westward toward Israel. And I think there's only one thing worse than being a false prophet, and that's being an accurate one. And we're seeing this happening now. So I was against it then, and for the degree, you know, you don't want to be too much of a Monday morning quarterback here, but against it now, I don't think it was a good idea.
We were talking earlier about this extension of the deadline for nuclear talks with Iran, and we have a cut from President Obama speaking this morning. Let's just give a listen to that.
There has been a lot of talk on the other side from the Iranian negotiators about whether, in fact, they can abide by some of the terms that came up in Luzon. If they cannot, that's going to be a problem. Because I've said from the start, I will walk away from the negotiations if, in fact, it's a bad deal.
Michael Oren, do you believe that?
Well, first of all, I'm very encouraged to hear the president say that. But I think he has to back up his words with deeds. Again, I mentioned before that this has been the administration's position since 2009, threatening to walk away. But no one has ever walked away. On the contrary, the Iranians keep on threatening to walk away, and the United States and what's called the P5 plus one, the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, keep on running after the Iranians saying, come back. And I think that has caused the Iranians to internalize that they have the upper hand in these negotiations. I think it's important to get to return the upper hand, restore the upper hand to the United States, to the West, and let the Iranians know that there's an end. At a certain point, there's going to be a deal on the table which is make or break.
Yeah.
That deal still may not be acceptable to Israel.
Well, and the sanctions are still in place, right? I mean, they have a lot of incentive to ultimately relent and give the inspectors full access and all the things that Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States has to have in this agreement, don't they?
The situation, of course, is a little bit more complicated. There are people who have grown rich off the sanctions in Iran, particularly around the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guards because they control the black markets.
Iran is also a democracy, and we did see the last election with someone being elected, Husseini, who really supports this dialogue and more of a cordial or constructive relationship with the United States. You just don't buy it.
Not really. It's a democracy with a very big asterisk after it. Rouhani was one of five candidates chosen by the Supreme Leader. We don't know whether he was chosen specifically to fulfill this role. In previous incarnations, he was a nuclear negotiator who was very proud of the fact that he pulled the wool over the West's eyes and was able to build a nuclear program. So we don't know that part. As for true democracy, if you get onto a website in Iran that's critical of the regime, you'll get a knock on the door and you'll disappear forever within a matter of minutes. It's not exactly a democracy as we know it.
Well, nor is Egypt.
Yeah, nor is Egypt. I wouldn't try to be, a homosexual in Iran. It's illegal. I wouldn't try to be, a feminist in Iran. You're going to have a great difficulty. Again, this goes to the heart of the debate. The heart of the debate that we had. I participated for 4.5 years in an intimate and candid dialogue with the United States over the Iran issue. And this was fascinating, Scott, because these were experts around the table and intelligence experts, physicists. And without divulging classified facts, we looked at the same data and we reached very close conclusions, really, about where the program was, how many centrifuges, what was the rate of enrichment, what could be the breakout rate. Where we differed was in our reading of the regime. And the American reading generally was, as the president said, this is a rational regime. They're not the nice bunch of guys. They deny the Holocaust. They support terror. They're anti-Semitic. But we can work with them. And at the end of the day, we can strike a deal. The Israeli position was very different. It was summed up in one line, and I'll end with this. President Obama said, Iran is not North Korea. Benjamin Netanyahu said, Iran is worse than 50 North Koreas.
Because
that says it all.
Because it has what?
Because North Korea is not the world's largest state sponsor of terror. North Korea is not threatening to wipe another country off the map. It's not genocidal in that way. There are many differences.
Yeah, and your feeling is that a deal would only embolden them,
and not just embolden them, it would enrich them. They'd get about $50 billion in sanctions relief. And here, that kicks us back to that essential question: rational, irrational. A rational country given $50 billion will use it to build up its infrastructure, education. An irrational country will use it to promote terror.
All right. Much more to come with Michael Oren. His new book is called Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide. Give us a call if you want to weigh in with a question or comment. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. More to come. Hey, and welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer in today for Michael Krasny. My guest this hour is Michael Oren. He was ambassador of Israel to the United States from 2009 to 2013. His new book, again, is called Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide. If you want to join us this morning, the number to call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And of course, you can email us as well. It's forum@kqed.org. Or leave a comment on Facebook, or you can tweet us as well. It's at KQED Forum. Michael Oren, you are in the Knesset, as you mentioned, and your party is part of the coalition with the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. From afar, It looks like a very precarious kind of coalition. describe it a little bit and just how precarious it is.
Well, we're a very different sort of democracy in the United States. I think it was Churchill who said that democracy is a terrible form of government except when you consider the alternatives. And I spent years in Washington of total political polarization between the parties, two parties. We have a multi-party system. We don't have political polarization. We actually get a lot of legislation done. But we have coalition forms of government. The one party has to put together a coalition. The prime minister – talk about team of rivals. Every minister in that government is actively trying to unseat the prime minister at any given time. And there's a lot of horse trading. You want to give one party the foreign ministry and the defense ministry. And at the end, Netanyahu couldn't put together a coalition that was larger than 61 seats out of the 120 seats in the Knesset. That gives you a two-seat majority, which is very, very nice. It's the narrowest Israel's ever had.
What did he do? Did he do anything wrong in those negotiations after the election?
I don't know. I wasn't privy to those negotiations. It was a long, drawn-out process. He's kept a couple of seats in government empty in case other people or parties want to come in. And I can only say that right now I can't see if any member of that coalition wants to go to elections. Elections are costly. They're a roll of the dice. You could lose.
Destabilizing.
Very destabilizing, even though they're much shorter than the United States. We have a three-month election cycle and a cap on giving per family of just over $2,000. So we don't have super PACs. They're very low-key elections. We have 1 hour of political advertising every night. All the parties advertise in that 1 hour and nobody watches it.
Some would say that's an improvement over right. What we do here. Let's read some email here. Enrique writes, can you explain why Israel is not at the table in negotiations over Iran's programs?
Well, we're not invited. It is between the five permanent members.
I suspect you're listening.
We try to follow as closely as we can, but it is between the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, the P5 plus one. They have been conducting these negotiations, though at times the United States has negotiated at length secretly with Iran face-to-face.
Another listener writes, other than being a strong ally, why should the U.S. support a nation that has a de facto apartheid state and a prime minister who used racist fear-mongering against Arabs to bring out the vote for himself? And referring there to Netanyahu's call on Election Day that
yes.
The Arabs were coming out in droves and you, meaning the right-wing voters, better get out, conservative voters better get out or else.
Okay. It's a very legitimate question. Israel's not an apartheid state. I'm serving in Knesset with 14 members, Arab members of Knesset. Who are Muslims, Christians. There are a number of Druze members of Knesset who are Arabic-speaking, a minority in Israel. Israel has the only legal communist party in the Middle East. And we have an Arab on our Supreme Court, Arabs in the army, Arabs in the university. It's not apartheid remotely. But the legitimate question, the prime minister made a very regrettable comment during the elections. Yes, that the Arab parties were coming out in droves and we've got to stop them. I was the architect of my party's reaction to that, which was a very strong condemnation of that. The prime minister Netanyahu later apologized. He called in the leaders of Israel's Arab community and apologized personally. I worked with him for close to 5 years. I was not a member of his party, but I was a professional working with him. I never heard him once express anything that was remotely racist, and that remark caught me off guard, to tell you the truth.
Was that just a Hail Mary desperation? I mean, was he that
apparently,
worried about losing?
I think so, perhaps. That's what appeared. He was down in the polls that day, and it was regrettable. And my party condemned it. I personally felt offended by it. I grew up around a lot of prejudice in my life. I was the only Jewish kid on my block. I got the stuffing beat out of me every day because I was Jewish.
You grew up in New Jersey?
In New Jersey. Yeah. But I lived in an entirely Sicilian neighborhood where, believe it or not, they filmed the first 2 years of The Sopranos. And then they got out. But tough neighborhood. And I have zero tolerance for intolerance. It's a deep part of my being. So I was deeply disturbed by this. I was somewhat comforted that the prime minister then came out and apologized.
All right. Let's go to the phones now. And Samir in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Good. What's up?
First of all, thank you for having me. I just wanted to make a comment on something the former prime minister said.
You know, Samir, I apologize. You have a really bad connection with your cell phone. I don't know if you're inside a building. Maybe you can move a little bit.
Can you hear me better now?
That's a little better. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I just thought it was... a little ironic how one of the main reasons the former prime minister said that Iran was a threat to Israel was that they could just wipe them out. But then he went on to go and boast of how their army is twice as big as Britain's and France's put together. Mm-hmm. And I just think that to put out that as a main reason that Iran could just come and wipe out Israel, I just think it's kind of illegitimate. And I just wanted to comment on that.
Okay.
It's a legitimate question, Samir. Let me respond to it. Iran is not going to wipe out Israel using its army. Iran with nuclear weapons, all the armies in the world are not going to stop it. And we know that, you know, the United States has an awful lot of nuclear weapons, but, you know, couldn't stop 9/11. There's the threat here is not of tanks and soldiers, though we have that threat, or of, you know, jet planes. The threat is it comes in several forms, and it all relates to Iran's nuclear capabilities. If Iran gets a bomb, it already has the missiles that were created to carry those bombs. And those bombs can reach any city in the state of Israel. And according to a former Iranian president, Rafsanjani, who was supposedly a moderate, he said that Israel's a one-bomb country. We're the size of New Jersey. So that's one danger. Iran is also the largest state sponsor of terror. And if Iran gets military nuclear capabilities, then they won't need a missile. They could just give it to a terrorist group and they could smuggle it in a ship container. So there, you can have the army the size of the United States and Russia combined. Nothing's going to protect you against that type of threat.
All right, Samir, thanks very much for the call. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Santa Clara now. Dan, welcome.
Good day. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I believe Mr. Olmert mentioned that there was a choice between whether Iran was viewed as an irrational or a rational actor.
Right.
I agree with that. That was critical. Picking up on that theme, were I a conservative Iranian politician, I would definitely want to have a nuclear weapon, looking at the past 15 years of the Middle East. I'd like him to address that.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. It's one that we would consider quite often. Now, the Iranians, one thing you must never do is underestimate their intelligence. They are extremely intelligent, and they play not only chess, they play multi-tier chess. So what did they have seen? They saw Muammar Gaddafi, who gave up his nuclear program, and they saw what happened to him. He died. They looked at the North Koreans, and they see that they experimented with nuclear weapons, and nobody messes with them.
They're also a failed country. I mean,
The Iranian regime is interested in two things. They're interested in regime survival and regional hegemony. That's their perspective. How do you achieve that? And the nuclear program is designed to do those two things. So Muammar Gaddafi didn't survive his regime. The North Koreans did. Then they looked at what happened with Bashar al-Assad. And this gets really interesting. Bashar al-Assad, you remember, in the September of 2013, was giving up his chemical weapons. Now, the chemical weapons in Syria were designed to ensure the regime's survival. And what he did, Assad, was to go from being part of the problem to being part of the solution. And the change was dramatic. Previously, the Obama administration had as its logo, its official policy, Assad must go. And that went in September 2013. He became part of the solution, not part of the problem. And the Iranians concluded that they too could be part of the solution. And that's what they've become now. I don't see that very much that the administration views, the Obama administration views Iran as part of the problem. Now it really is part of the solution. Mm. So the Iranians are very, very perceptive, and they draw lessons. They're taking notes. And they are trying to ensure their survival as a regime and to ensure their regional hegemony, and they're not doing bad.
Yeah. Dan, thanks for the call. You know, we're talking earlier about Iraq and the invasion of Iraq and how, you know, a country like Iraq needs to have, you know, in some cases, a brutal dictator that holds the country together. Do you feel the same way about Syria?
Yes. Well, today, if you ask an Israeli intelligence analyst if Syria and Iraq actually exist, he'll say, no, there is no Syria anymore. There is no Iraq anymore. These are outdated terms.
So in that sense, did you support keeping Assad in power?
Well, the problem with Assad from Israel's perspective was that he was a close ally of Iran. And there was a strategic arc, an Iranian arc, that extended from Tehran through Damascus to Beirut. And that included not only the Iranian nuclear program and support for terror, but most importantly from Israel, 100,000 rockets in the hands of Hezbollah. That's more rockets than all of NATO has. They can hit any city in the state of Israel. very advanced rockets. So that was a crucial consideration for us. But just before I left Israel, I'm a member of the Defense and Foreign Affairs Committee, and we had a briefing by our new chief of staff, General Eisenkotten. And for the first time, I saw a map of what the Middle East looks like as of last week. And Scott, you would not believe what the Middle East looks like. In fact, the Assad regime controls only a small part of Syria today. Most of it is divided up between ISIS and Hezbollah.
So what would you like to see happen?
Iraq doesn't look different. There's no Iraq anymore.
Yeah. What would you like to see happen in Syria?
Well, if such a place exists anymore, we'd like to see the Iranian connection broken between, say, Tehran and Beirut and Hezbollah. We'd like to see Hezbollah set back. There are no great scenarios. There are only worse scenarios. ISIS is no threat of Israel either. But right now, ISIS doesn't have the 100,000 rockets. So right now, chaos. It's not ideal. As long as the chaos is not spilling over our border, then it's a less bad scenario. But we have to be prepared for that as well.
The worst kept secret in the Middle East is that, and I'm sure you won't confirm this, but that Israel has a nuclear weapon or a capacity. If that were true, wouldn't that give Israel more security in thinking about Iran and some kind of a nuclear deal with Iran?
Well, our official position has been since the 1950s that Israel will not be the first country to introduce nuclear weapons to the Middle East.
What do you mean by introduce? What does that mean?
The first person to actually to make them and introduce them to the Middle East. That's what we say. It's called as an opaque position, but. Let's go to your question. What does that mean in terms of a nuclear-armed Iran? The huge difference between Israel and Iran is that Israel's not threatening to wipe Iran off the map. So there's no symmetry here. Iran is actively threatening us, and not just actively threatening us by words. They're threatening us by deeds. They've conducted terrorist attacks against Israeli and Jewish targets across 5 continents and 35 cities. There was an attempt to blow up my embassy in Washington, D.C., in the capital of the United States. They're quite brazen in their terror. So it's a complete different magnitude of threat. And then this notion of being a one-bomb country. Iran is half the size of Europe. We are the size of New Jersey. Nuclear weapons for us are a completely different magnitude of threat. And we have to take it seriously. Israel's margin for error on Iran is exactly zero.
All right, let's go to some more email. Listener writes, if Bush, Jeb Bush, and Hillary Clinton campaign on a platform of a much tougher stance toward the Iranians, might that impel them to sign while Obama is still in office? That may be the final deadline for them.
It's very hypothetical. That's like hypothetical on the hypothetical. I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's very important. It is hard to imagine that this deadline is going to be extended indefinitely, right? I mean,
indefinitely is an interesting concept, but I think that, again, it's very important that a deadline be put down, that at some point the Iranians internalize. Our position, Israel's position, was always that the sanctions brought Iran to the negotiating table, that if you ratchet up the sanctions and you put a credible military threat on the table, that's what would bring about a good agreement. Why? And I'll be very brief here. The Iranians are paying a very high price for the nuclear program. They've paid tens of billions of dollars, even with the sanctions, tens of billions of dollars. But they believe at the end of the day they will have the weapon because you're paying a price, but eventually they'll have the thing. The credible military threat basically says to the Iranians, you can pay this price, but you're going to be paying it for naught because at the end of the day, you're not going to get the thing. And that's what brings them to the table. And the great paradox is the more credible the military threat, the less chance you'll actually have to use it.
Yeah. All right. Another email here. Nancy writes, Israel's response to Palestinian violence, the growth of the settlements, and Netanyahu's extreme disrespect to President Obama have, in my view, removed any consideration Israel has to preference on the part of the United States. These certainly disgusted this American of Jewish ancestry. Mm-hmm. And Michael Oren, Israel has had a hard time with American Jews in terms of their identification with the state of Israel.
Certainly with a significant portion of the American Jewish community, and I interacted with that community. I'm still interacting with that community. It's important we keep that dialogue open.
What do you think is the basis? I mean, Israel has undertaken and discussed policies that a lot of American Jews find distasteful. But what do you see as the reason for the weakening of that bond?
Well, you can say that there's opposition to Israel settlement policy in Israel. There's opposition to the settlement policy within Israel itself. I don't subscribe to Israel's current settlement policy. For example, I have a different attitude toward it. But I think to be honest, that the differences go deeper. A lot of it has to do with the differences in our experiences as communities. If you go to an Israeli Jew, for example, and say the word Selma, right, he'll think it's his aunt in Long Island, or maybe, you know, some relative. The word Selma for an American Jew has deep historic resonance, and it touches the soul of many American Jews
who participated in the civil rights movement.
But look at the civil rights movement in general as sort of a high point in the American Jewish experience and the fight for American Jewish rights, because the American Jewish community is an enormously successful community. Now, that doesn't resonate with Israelis. They don't understand it. On this side, among American Jews, it's very difficult, and not impossible, but difficult for them to understand often our experiences, how Israel signed an agreement with the PLO in 1993 and got hundreds of suicide bombers that killed 1,000 Israelis. We withdrew from Lebanon in 2000, got thousands of rockets from Hezbollah. We withdrew from Gaza in 2005, got thousands of rockets from Hamas up to last summer. I wrote part of this book under rocket fire, literally under rocket fire. I keep running from my bomb shelter. That's a difficult thing for people, just Americans in general. What if we were sitting in this studio, and it happened to me a lot in Israel, we'd have to run to the bomb shelter in the middle of this interview because a rocket's coming in.
Yeah. You write in the book about your having met Yitzhak Rabin when you were a young man even a teenager, maybe?
15.
15 years old. Mm-hmm. You ever think of how history would have been different if he had lived, if he hadn't been assassinated?
Well, I had the great privilege of working in his government. I was working at the government at the time of his assassination. And to say that this was a traumatic period is an understatement. You can't see me in listening to me, but my hair is white, and it really went white during that period. I also lost my sister-in-law in that period to a suicide bomber, all within 2 months. And my sister-in-law, from a native of San Francisco, who was visiting Israel on a scholarship, was killed by a suicide bomber. Very traumatic period. At the time, there was rising opposition to what was known as the Oslo Peace Accords. I wasn't sure if we went to elections that we'd actually win, to tell you the truth. But history as a way of humbling us, we don't know how things would have turned out. At the end of the day, the differences between Israel and the Palestinians are so deep and so historical, in many cases religious, that I don't know if one leader or another would make the difference. Certainly if there were brave leaders on other sides, it would have made a difference. I don't think Yasser Arafat, frankly, was that leader.
Yeah. Well, he turned down the deal that Prime Minister Barak, Ehud Barak, had which I think was going to divide East Jerusalem, wasn't it?
It was.
Jerusalem,
right? It was. Yeah. There were two offers. One was made in 2000. One was made in 2008. The 2008 was even more forthcoming. But basically, it was a Palestinian state in all of Gaza, the overwhelming majority of the West Bank and half of Jerusalem. And both times, those offers were not accepted.
Yeah, and that won't come around again anytime soon, that offer.
Not anytime soon. But also, because the Middle East has also changed, keep in mind.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones. Joseph in Oakland, welcome.
Hi. So my question is, you stated that keeping the sanctions as well as with threat of a military action would have been a better option, would have been a really good option. The previous administration, before this administration, had that option. I mean, in fact, they had a Congress that was predominantly pro-Israel, as well as a president who was pro-Israel. So are you suggesting that this administration is taking the military option off its policy, and as well as how long do we go with the old rhetoric of sanction, when it hasn't produced any viable results?
Yeah. Michael Oren?
Well, I take strong issue with the notion that sanctions haven't produced results. The sanctions brought the Iranians to the table. They didn't come to the table because they wanted to come to the table. They were called to the table because they were forced to come to the table. And so sanctions were an important part of this, and Israel played an important role in generating the momentum for sanctions in the world. And it was and remains our policy that the sanctions should not only be maintained but strengthened. Keep in mind, we've talked a lot about Iran's threat to Israel. But Iran's threat is not just Israel. Iran's threat is to the entire Middle East and ultimately to the United States. And again, the world's largest state sponsor of terror. It's operating in along America's border. It's operating in South America. I would not in any way say that in any way diminish the threat posed by Iran, not just Israel. And then once Iran gets the bomb, understand that just about everybody gets the bomb. Egypt gets the bomb. Saudi Arabia gets the bomb. Turkey gets the bomb. You saw how concerned everyone was about Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons. Imagine if you have all these insecure Middle Eastern states that have nuclear arsenals and what that means for America's security. I think that's something you have to keep in mind. I don't think it's rhetoric. I think this is a issue that not only affects the life of my children, Joseph, but ultimately may affect the lives of your children as well.
All right, Joseph, thanks for the call. You know, you talk about the proliferation of nuclear weapons. There was a report not that long ago that Israel had offered to give nuclear weapons to or technology capability to South Africa in the 80s. They were very close with P.W. Botha, and I think it was Shimon Peres was prime minister at the time. Do you think that that support of South Africa during apartheid, do you think that may have had any impact on President Obama's attitude?
I have no evidence of that. I did the Obama 101 course. Obama had a strong feeling about colonialism, anti-colonialism, certainly no fan of the apartheid regime in South Africa. I don't think it's the proudest chapter in Israel's history. I understand Shimon Peres is a man of peace. I had the great honor of working with him extensively. And in the 80s when Israel had no friends and was surrounded by a lot of enemies, you didn't get particularly choosy with your friends. But I wasn't – I was never comfortable with that choice. And in retrospect, I think it was not the wisest choice.
Certainly the wrong side of history.
Definitely the wrong side of history. And it's something I think we have to be discuss openly. I tried to do when I was ambassador I tried to have organize a panel discussion at Harvard about that period in Israel because I think it's very important that we put it out on the table. And I think since Israel's relationship with the African American community in this country in general is a crucial issue, and I devoted a lot of time for it.
Why do you feel it's so crucial?
I think, first of all, I think we share a lot in our common history. It is an influential community in this country. It's a community that doesn't always know Israel very well. And here, Israel is a country that is many people. I went around whenever I used to travel, and an ambassador always wants to get out of Washington. Whenever you can get out of Washington, travel around. I would always go to cities where there would be a strong African American leadership. And one of the things I would show them was a photograph that was taken of an elite Israeli army unit training. They're all running with a stretcher and sweating. One of the young men in the front is our eldest son, who was an officer in the army in this unit. But what you notice from the picture right about is that it is multiracial. About half the soldiers are African. People in this country, particularly African Americans, don't think of Israel being a country which is partially African. And I have two African members of my party in
from
Knesset.
Ethiopia?
From Ethiopia.
Yeah.
So that's I want to be able to introduce that Israel to African Americans as well.
All right. Here's a note from Kimberly. Writes on our Facebook page. I think it's perfectly right to criticize Israel when it's treating people who are different, either in religion or ethnicity, as second class citizens. They need to be called on the carpet about their behavior. They don't get a free ride. We have another listener who writes, this discussion is totally one-sided and absurd. Why doesn't Michael Oren talk about how Israel hurt Israel-U.S. relations with their multiple devastating wars against Gaza while Obama has been in office? We do often cover these issues. This is not the only discussion we've
Keep
had.
Keep going, Scott.
Another listener writes, while Israel has an excess of 400 nuclear bombs and always refused to enter any of the international agreements, now he wants us to nuke Iran. I don't think anybody's talking about nuking Iran.
No, God forbid.
Another comment here. Let's see. Actually, we can mix these up. Ricardo writes, do you think Israel and the U.S. would agree to stationing U.S. troops in Israel, similar to what the U.S. does in South Korea as a tripwire? This might prevent Iran from carrying out any threat to Israel, any kind of a NATO presence in the Middle East?
Well, that's an interesting question. Let me go to the first questions about Israel's war against Gaza. I think that Israel doesn't go to war against Gaza, but Hamas and Gaza has gone repeatedly to war against Israel. Last summer, Hamas kidnapped three Israeli teenagers, massacred them, and then proceeded to fire thousands of rockets at us, about 4,500 rockets. Israel has to defend itself. I think this is a reality that is so far removed from the American experience it's difficult to comprehend here. But Israel has to defend itself. We have no choice. 8 million Israelis under rocket fire.
I think there's also – I really want to interrupt your thought here. But, you know, many Americans, American Jews – I'm an American Jew – I feel that, you know, Israel is so much stronger – economically, militarily, technologically, in every way imaginable than the Palestinians. Why not take a bit of a risk with peace? And because if it doesn't work out, you're still going to be in so much of a stronger position. Why not just go that extra length?
I think Israel has taken risks for peace. We signed this agreement with the PLO in 1993. We brought the PLO back from Tunisia. We gave them arms. And then we learned that they'll turn around and blow up our buses. So that you know, we've taken risks all along. We risk by.
But that hasn't. That policy has ended. I mean, that by and large, or is that because of the wall? And I mean, it seemed like there was condemnation from within among Palestinian leadership that wasn't the way to go.
Formally, it's still the Palestinian position. Formally, it's still Israel's position that we should sit down and negotiate. That hasn't changed. We withdrew from Gaza in 2005. I was part of that operation as an Israeli officer. It was very traumatic for us, pulling Jews out of our hand. We yanked 9,000 people out of their homes to create a momentum for peace. And we didn't get peace. We got terror in a very large scale. So Israel has taken risks over and over again. The risks have proven to us and makes it very difficult for myself and even being a politician who's trying to say, okay, let's take risks again. I'll go into a parlor meeting in some house in Greater Tel Aviv and they'll say, you want to put a missile into my living room by taking risks. It's a hard argument to try to convince people. Because history, you talk about being on the right side of history. History it basically presents a lot of evidence against my argument for taking further risks.
All right. Michael Oren, his new book is called Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide. You're appearing tonight at the JCC in
Palo Alto?
Yes. And it's 7 p.m., so I assume there are still tickets left.
I don't know. I hope not in a way.
You hope not.
I could.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks,
complicated
Scott.
Topic.
Always.
And appreciate your candor on this. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. For Michael Krasny and all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.